Eveen and Company with Eveen Ihuliwan on RTE Radio 1.
Good morning. My guests this morning spend their working days exploring the frontiers of human knowledge. Professor Peter Gallagher is a physicist who studies the sun, while Professor Emma Teeling is a biologist who works with bats. Outside the lab, they're married and live in Dublin with their two young children. At the moment, there's an upsurge in interest in science, but beyond school and college, they can tell us the truly interesting places a career in science can lead. So you're both very welcome to studio.
Good morning.
Emma, first of all, you're known as Ireland's bat woman. How did you get into studying bats, of all things?
Well, I suppose I started off as a zoologist, and I was very interested in trying to look at all the different species of animals that we have on our planet and understand where they came from and how did they get to be the way they were, and why could some fly, why could some swim, why did some seem to have immunity to certain diseases that are killing us. And it was just something that really interested me. As an undergraduate, I got involved in field behaviour, looked at foxes, looked at cats, lots of different things. And then all of a sudden I was looking to do a PhD, and I saw an advertisement in UCD about a PhD to look at the evolution of bats up in Queens in Belfast. Thought, maybe I'll apply. And within 6 weeks of starting my PhD, I became completely hooked because I started to understand a bit about what they can do, why they're so special, why they're important for our environment, what studying them can tell us about how our own genes work, how our own different proteins work. Why can they fly? Why do they live for so long? So I suppose I got completely hooked, and it's a fascinating place to be, and I've been studying these now really for the past 20 years.
Most people are quite nervous about them. I mean, would you ever have been kind of a little bit afraid of bats? Because, you know, people get afraid of them being in your hair, and we hear all horrible things about these creatures.
If you saw one up close, which we, of course, have been lucky enough to do, you'd realise they're stunningly beautiful little mammals. They have, you know, lovely little faces, and they're very furry. And yes, they have wings, which are very, very different. It's fear of the unknown. You're always scared of things that you don't know about. So bats didn't frighten me at all. Now, spiders, yeah, they bother me. And, you know, when you go out into caves catching bats or into attics catching bats, there's lots of spiders. So I have to get over that.
But I find that fascinating because you're so interested in the natural world and yet you don't like the insects.
Well, no, they're not insects. They're arachnids. So they're different. They have 8 legs, not 6.
Okay.
This is the one thing as a zoologist, you just always have to correct people on that point. But I find them unbelievably fascinating. I tried to get over my phobia of spiders by writing articles on using them as a format to try and understand animal communication. So studying spider mating systems. And I would force myself to try and look at pictures. So they're wonderful science. Their communication system is amazing. You know, their biology is spectacular. How can they weave silk? How can they make silk? And although I have a huge respect for them, they still terrify me.
And how do the spiders communicate?
Think about it, you know, when do they come? If they're not a social spider, they typically only come together to mate, and that's usually quite dangerous for the male.
Why?
Well, because the females usually will assume that he's a prey and eat him. And so if you remember, female spiders are much bigger than the male spiders, which are much smaller. And so you have short-sighted spiders and you have the web-weaving spiders. And so sometimes a male is looking to mate with this very large female sitting in the middle of the web and needs to come over and needs to tap some of the different, I suppose, nearly like tent lines that holds the web up, and tap in a certain way so she realises it's an approaching spider as opposed to an approaching prey.
So it's a bit like Morse code.
Yeah, or else they come along with nuptial gifts. So they bring this dead insect all wrapped up and present it to her, and while she's eating it, they have their wicked way.
And on that nuptial gift, Peter, I think you gave Emma a present of a spider at one stage.
Oh my God, I can't believe she brought that up. Yes, I have a tooth that had to be capped as a result of that present.
Why on earth did you think giving her a spider was a good idea?
In retrospect, it probably wasn't a very good idea, but she was doing a collection, an invertebrate collection in UCD as part of one of her projects. And I found this enormous hairy spider in the bathtub in my parents' house. And I thought, I better give this one to Emma. So I went and I got a jam jar and put the big hairy spider in it. And I just lived around the corner from Emma, and I brought it round to her house, knocked on the door, and she opened up the door, and I basically ran at her with the jam jar. And Emma threw her hands up in the air, hit the jam jar, and the jam jar went up and hit me in the face and broke my tooth.
That's not how I remember. She pinned me down, if I remember. So I got a hand free to protect myself.
I remember the next day I went back to my mom and I said, look what Emma did to me. And my mom said, what happened to you? And I told her the story, and she said, you deserved it. And she was right as well.
And then I realised she would be a brilliant brilliant mother-in-law.
Excellent. Well, Peter, your area of interest is very different then to Emma's, because Emma's is all the natural world and the world that we see all around us. But you, in fact, study the sun. So what is it about that that you find so fascinating?
You know, that's interesting. I feel that I do study the natural world. I study a very different natural world. So, you know, I'm very interested in the way the world around us works. If it's the way light comes from the light bulbs, or if it's the way electricity flows, or if it's the way things move up and down in our Earth's gravity. So I see, you know, understanding the stars and the galaxies and the universe and the sun all as part of that ecosystem that we live in. And I've always been fascinated by it. You know, even this morning I went for a run down along Dollymount Strand, and I saw a boat going out, and there was a bow wave in front of the boat, and I was just looking at it, and I actually stopped running to look at the bow wave. And the shape of the bow wave tells you about the shape of the boat. It tells you how the speed of the boat is going. And then it reflected off all the rocks, and it went out as a straight line, you know, a straight wave. And that's weird. Why would it go out as a straight line? Because it just hit lots of rocks, and some of them are small and some of them are big. So you'd think that there'd be small waves and big waves, but all the waves come together and forms a straight line. So, you know, I guess I'm fascinated by the natural world as well. And the sun is an interesting one. I guess I didn't really start. I was more interested in the abstract kind of Stephen Hawking stuff, black holes, the evolution of the universe, when I was an undergraduate. And then I realised that it's very hard to make measurements of them. I'm kind of I'm an experimental physicist.
What does experimental physicist mean?
Well, I mean, physics is, I like doing experiments. So you want to work out what the temperature is of something. You want to work out what its properties are. I don't like the abstract stuff too much. I don't like the philosophical physics. I like the stuff that I can, you know, build an instrument for, go out into space and make a measurement, you know. And with the sun, it was a star that we could see. We can send spacecraft, you know, NASA or the European Space Agency, we can send spacecraft out into space. We can take pictures. We can see what's going on the surface of the sun. And then the sun has a wind that flies past the spacecraft, and you can actually, you know, tastes the solar wind. You can measure its temperature and its density and its magnetic field as it goes past the spacecraft. So it was kind of tangible astrophysics. It was astrophysics that we could do like the way we do any other experiment on Earth. So that's why I thought the sun was just very cool.
And you're obviously both incredibly observant in the world around you. Is that the important feature of being a scientist?
I would say yes. It's not necessarily observant. I think he's probably more observant about certain things than me, because I get very caught up in a certain situation and then I'm focused very much on that. But it's not necessarily observant. I would say you have to, actually, you know, maybe that is the right word. What we're trying to do is look for patterns in nature. We're trying to understand it. And so you see something and it's happening over and over again, and you ask yourself, why is this happening? It's really more curiosity, maybe more than observance. You have to be very, very curious. Always as a child, I was very curious about why things were a certain way. You know, why did ferns curl? Why would sheep only have babies at certain times of the year? You know, why was it winter? Why was it summer? You know, where did the fish go? Where would they sleep? So again, it's really like a childhood curiosity that you keep, and you still, you know, we still are like that. We're still very fascinated, still very curious. You know, reading papers right now, or reading any type of research, his research too, I ask the questions, why?
Does that help, actually, that you're both scientists but you don't really know each other's fields?
It has a good thing and a bad thing. The good thing is that we talk a lot about science, and we talk a lot about our universities, and we talk a lot about our careers to each other. And in fact, we've helped each other, I think, a lot over the years. You know, when I'm setting out a scientific question, I'll say it to Emma, and she'll say, well, I think that's stupid.
I would never.
Only the way a wife can do. But she would, you know, we discuss a particular idea that I may have, or vice versa, and we kind of hone the thinking sometimes. But it's done very informally over dinner or something like that. But it's interesting, you know, this idea of kind of a childlike curiosity, just to get back to that. We have a six-year-old boy, and, you know, I don't know what he's really interested in. He's interested in art, and he's interested in, what's he interested in at the moment? What are those toys?
Trash bags.
Yeah, the trash bags are all over the house at the moment. But he asks scientific questions that get me the whole time. You know, they're the really hard ones, you know. Why is the sky blue questions? Where do babies come from is an interesting one.
How do you maintain that curiosity then? Because you both said that you had it as children and obviously as young people, but do you ever feel that you're finding the answer out, you know, and then you're kind of less curious about it then?
One thing that you realise about science is people think that, you know, you do A and you get B and you find the answer. In science, you don't necessarily find the answer, and that can be really frustrating, especially for researchers who are new to the field. They're discovering that there isn't a definitive answer. And people think science has the definitive answer. And a lot of the time it's a quest. And over 10 years or 20 years, the whole of humanity or scientists on the planet will move it slightly bit forward. So you don't always find a definitive answer, which can be very frustrating. But to me, that's part of the challenge of trying to progress science a little bit more and progress our understanding of the world that we live in.
Mm-hmm. Drives me nuts.
Why?
I just find that it's, you start reading, I'm going to find the answer. I need to know, did fruit bats lose their ability to echolocate? Yes or no? I'm still asking that question, probably will be until I die. And it's just something that drives you. And the more you discover, the more you know you don't know. As I say, the more you know, the more you know you don't know. And when my first years come in, I think they all expect, right, I'm going to read this textbook and I'm going to know everything. And what we try to do in first year, you know, all through to when they graduate, is it's to instill the sense that you're the one who's going to make the discoveries. We don't know this yet. Yeah, that doesn't mean that we're bad scientists. It just means that this is how humanity moves our understanding forward. And this is part of what you're going to do. But I find it frustrating. It wakes me up in the middle of the night. And these are the type of things that I'd like to know the answer. And that's what drives me. Let's find the answer.
And what's the answer to the bats then, Emma? Like, do they hold the secret of youth?
I hope so, and I believe so. And if you think about it, they defy all of these rates of living hypotheses. And what does that mean? That means that typically in mammals and vertebrates, there's a correlation between, or there's a link between things that are small, live fast, die young. Things that are big, live slow, live for a long time. Think how long an elephant lives for, how long a whale lives for.
How long do they live for?
They can live for up to 200 years, I would say, on the outset. This would be some whales. And think about a mouse. They can die within a year or two, or even in a shorter time. So the reality is that bats are very, very small, have a ridiculously high metabolic rate, but they live 9 times longer than expected without any type of medical intervention. And the question is, how can they do that? So it has to lie deep within their DNA. And this is a project that now my research group are involved in, trying to unlock this secret. This is one of the reasons why I stayed with bats, because I'd learned about that in the beginning and thought, what are they doing? How can they possibly? That's not right. That isn't possible. But the more you look into it, I mean, when you catch them, you can't really age a bat because they don't look older. They don't seem to go deaf. They perhaps have immunity to different types of cancers. And so this is what we're trying to do. So this is being observant about the natural world, being curious, and then finding a way to answer it by linking together different types of methodologies to do that.
And could that ever be linked then to human health?
Yeah, because if you think about it, we share the same genome pretty much. So are the, you know, a gene to make one protein is the same in us as it is in a bat. So what we want to do is see how have they switched, what mutations have happened within these genes or within the things that regulate these genes to stop them aging like we do, to prevent cancer that might cause that, to present a potential type of cancer, or to maybe have a way of finding, dealing with the negative effects of aging. How do they do that? And if we can work out what they can do, potentially we can then use that for therapies, gene therapy. This is the future, I do believe.
So bats is actually the way forward for
Absolutely.
Us. Emma, that's your current research topic. Peter, tell me about yours. What's your current project that you're working on? Because I think you've got a paper, is that correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, my big thing is trying to understand solar flares. These are huge explosions that happen on the surface of the sun. And they produce more energy than, you know, if you took all the nuclear weapons on the planet and blew them all up in 1 minute. That's how big these things are. And they throw out lots of electrons and protons into space. And sometimes
lots of tiny particles.
Lots of tiny little, the bits that atoms are made up of, and sometimes they hit the Earth, and when they do hit the Earth, they can produce the Northern Lights. You know, that's one of the spectacular things that
Borealis.
The Aurora Borealis. In fact, my 40th birthday present is going up to Tromsø with Emma to go and see the Northern Lights for the first time. So even though I'm a scientist who's studying these things, I haven't seen them. But anyway, I'm interested in understanding the basic physics. So what causes these explosions? We just don't know. We think they're related to sunspots. Actually, we know they're related to sunspots. But in a sunspot, it's got lots of magnetic field, and it generates lots of energy, and it stores lots of energy. And sometimes, we don't know why, the energy gets released as this huge big solar flare. So that's what one of the things I'm doing at the moment. And we have, you know, mathematics students and chemistry students and physics students and engineering students all working together to try and answer this question. And you kind of think, well, so what, we'll be able to do what with that? Well, maybe we'll be able to predict the Northern Lights with a bit more accuracy. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is that these solar flares can knock out satellites, they can affect the power grid, they can affect radio communications as well, and they can cause huge blackouts. And, you know, worst case scenario, if you're an astronaut on your way to Mars or onto the moon, it could be fatal for them.
And what about the research project that might be happening here in Ireland that you're working on?
Yeah, my big thing, and this has been ruining all my jogs for the past 2 years, is trying to build a radio telescope in Birr Castle. You know, Birr is a very special place for Irish science or Irish culture in that the largest telescope in the world was in Birr Castle from the 1840s right up until the 1920s when the Americans built a 100-inch diameter telescope. And that telescope just did amazing things. It was the first telescope to see that galaxies had spirals in them. We never knew that galaxies had spiral arms in them. He was the man who named a thing called the Crab Nebula, and it's very famous if you're an astronomer, but it's a star that blew up, and he called it a crab because it looked like a crab, and every astronomer in the world knows the Crab Nebula, and that came from a discovery made in County Offaly. So, you know, there's a great tradition, a great culture of that scientific research, and what we're doing now is we're trying to build a radio telescope down there, and we want to build a huge radio telescope that basically allows Irish scientists to do the cutting edge yet again.
And you've some data from Birr for your latest paper.
We've picked up some solar radio bursts. So when a solar flare goes off, it gives a burst of radio waves. So we've picked up a radio burst. It looks very interesting, and we've just had it accepted in a major scientific journal. So we're really happy about that. And it's the first time that scientific data has been published from Birr Castle since 1908, wonderful, which is an interesting kind of, you know, look back on what was done in the past. And the fourth Earl of Ross, I think it was, he measured the temperature of the moon. He was the first man in the world to measure the temperature of the moon, done here in Ireland.
So Ireland was pretty famous for its science maybe about a century ago. Is this a new time of vibrancy for scientific research then?
Oh, I think things have just changed 100-fold in the past 10, 15 years. And it's come from investment in science and enthusing kids in science and bringing students, smart kids, into science and bringing people back internationally who want to come and work in Ireland, where there's a vibrant activity in science that just wasn't there in the 80s or in the 70s. And it's great to kind of kickstart that scientific tradition that we have. I mean, if you think about the names, Kelvin was born in Ireland. Hamilton, one of the greatest mathematicians of all time, was born in Ireland and worked in Ireland. We've had Beaufort as well, was another Irish. Boole, the creator of the mathematics for computers. All of these great names that were Irish and I think as important to world culture as George Bernard Shaw or W.B. Yeats. And I think that's something that Irish people need to remember and cherish and build on.
But back onto that point, when I left Ireland, I suppose it would have been in the early 1990s, I left, went to Edinburgh, then went over to America. One of the reasons for coming home was we had Bertie Ahern at the time was going around selling Irish science to all the expats in Washington, D.C. And suddenly Ireland looked like it was a place that we could actually do science. So I was always very passionate about Irish science and always wanted to come back home. But then I didn't want to come back home to a place where I was going to be paralyzed and not be able to do the science I needed. Why would you leave America? Why would you leave the UK? Why would you come back if you really are a scientist at heart? But all the investment in Science Foundation in Ireland, in other funding bodies here in Ireland, made all of this possible. So we got to try and keep that going so we can keep on promoting Irish science. Our research impact internationally is just exponentially expanding over the past 15 years. So we've got to keep that going.
Interesting then, Peter, that your first choice of music is I Fought the Law and the Low One, which is quite anarchic when you're really talking about the structures that are here.
But science is anarchic, you know, it is about anarchy in some ways. You know, if you look at science, where are the great discoveries made? They're made by people who think disruptively. They disrupt the paradigm. And I think that's what, for me, punk rock did in the 1970s. It gave two fingers to the established music and it took us in a completely new direction that revolutionised music. And if you look at science, that's exactly what it is. It's people who think different who make the big discoveries.
So you're equating scientists to punk rockers?
Absolutely.
Absolutely, I would agree.
Let's have a listen to The Clash. The Clash, I Fought the Law. Emma, tell me, how did you meet Peter?
Met him or saw him, which from
what
the very
first?
Beginning. So I suppose I the first time I ever set eyes on Peter Gallagher was in the institute where I was going for grinds for my leaving cert. I think my parents were convinced I was going to fail everything. So they said, right, you're going to go for extra grinds. And so I saw him. It was one of those rare snowy days. And I had this big tall fella in a Parker jacket, or was it a bin man's jacket at the time, long hair, and had a snowball in his hand and was looking at me. I thought, he's going to throw it at me. I thought, oh, what am I going to do? So I just stared him down and he dropped the ball. And we wandered on. So he was in my mind from then on.
Peter, do you remember that throwing the ball?
I absolutely do. Yeah, I wasn't going to throw it at her at all. I can't remember who I was going to throw it at, but I do remember that moment, because I used to go for chemistry grinds on a Saturday morning in Leeson Street. And I do remember keeping an eye out for her coming out, because I always thought she was beautiful. She had this, or she still has this lovely long blonde hair, and I just thought, wow, she looks
amazing. Now I'm blushing.
But yeah, so you know, she just caught my eye immediately.
But then, sorry, Emma.
So then we were then, and I was in big 500 people in a class in UCD in one of the big lecture halls. I'm sure you remember. I think it was theatre. Is it theatre A, theatre B? And I saw this guy, and he was looking up at me, and I was looking down at him. I was like, could I recognise him? But I didn't realise that he lived round the corner from me. And so then it would have been about 2 or 3 weeks into UCD. I was late and I'd run down to get the 30 bus as it was at the time. And I saw himself and all his friends hanging out at the bus stop. And I was going to go and say hello, but I thought, no, he's a boy. I can't do it. And then about a week later, he had worked out speaking to a friend of mine, somebody that I
had. In a physics lab.
That because I had to take two buses in, that I was obviously from Clontarf. And then we just got talking and we became very good friends. I mean, we became best friends first. And I brought a group of friends that I knew from First Science. He brought a group of friends together that he knew from First Science. And we're now all brilliant best friends and have stayed that way
and
for years.
It's interesting. I think is there four couples who all have children very from First Science and UCD?
About.
So scientists can actually develop relationships and have
with
children.
With each other. There's about 12 babies.
But hold on, you haven't told me about developing the relationship. Because you said you just became friends and then
became
then
friends for a long time.
Mayo.
And then we became friends for a long time. And I remember I was going off to America to work on a J-1 visa and he wasn't going. And he came to borrow my guitar. And he turns up and he gave me, I was laughing, saying, so where's my present then if you want this guitar? And he goes, here. And he handed me a necklace that was this, I think, moss agate in the shape of a heart. And I looked at him and he looked at me and then we went off to America. And then I decided, God, I think I might be falling in love with my best friend. Not a good idea. Ooh. My dad always warned me against him. He said, you can't be friends with boys. It's not possible. And I said, ridiculous. Of course you can. But I guess dad was right. And so then when I came back from the States, I had a boyfriend at the time, but I realised that things weren't working out with that boyfriend and that, so we broke up. And then it was my 20th birthday and we ended up going away down for a party down in Westport in our friend's house. And then let's just say our relationship became non-platonic. That's all I'm saying.
Peter, how did you feel when she was going to America for that summer? Why did you give her that necklace?
Why did I give her that necklace? Oh, God. I remember going into town to buy her a present and I was walking around the stores trying to... This is hopelessly romantic. But anyway, I walked around the stores and I was looking to buy her some piece of jewellery and there was this moss agate love heart and I said, oh, wow, that's a bit cheeky. And I just...
fancied her.
Oh, completely. Absolutely.
You denied it always.
Yeah, completely. And so I just bought it and I gave it to her and I shouldn't have given it to her.
Were
it
was being disingenuous the whole time then, pretending to be friends if you liked her all of that time?
No. I had other girlfriends.
He liked more than me. It wasn't just me.
I had other girlfriends as well who are still friends of ours. And, you know, so... I think with Emma, I just, her personality is, you can't get a word in edgeways for a lot of the time. And I just loved it and I found it so entertaining. And so...
You bought the necklace.
But I just really liked the way she talked and her personality and we come from very similar backgrounds.
And we were friends.
And we were best friends. I mean, absolutely inseparable best friends.
Was that difficult then to go from being best friends to then being in a couple?
Not for me. I remember trying to force her to hold hands with me in UCD as we walked through campus and she wouldn't hold my hand.
Why?
It was just too weird. I find it very, very strange because I'm not necessarily that touchy-feely person and he's much more touchy-feely. And the whole idea that we had to change them, I'm not very good at change at all. I like things to stay the way they are. But I was falling in love with my best friend and people always said, when we come back in 10, 20 years' time, this is in the science canteen, you two will be married. Don't be ridiculous. But I quite liked the idea of it.
Yeah,
but then he insisted on holding hands, insisted on putting his arm around me. I tried to fight against it, but as usual, he's very persistent and always wins. So then it became okay.
And tell me then, like, because you obviously get on incredibly well and you both have very similar interests, then are there rows? Do you row about stuff?
Absolutely, we row it. Yeah,
he's always wrong.
We definitely, we're quite, I think we're both quite emotional and forceful with our opinions. But we have a lot of discussion about things, there'd never be any kind of tension in the house because we chat about it immediately and get it sorted out. Certainly with Emma, that's something I learned with Emma. She just says it immediately. If I'm doing something that's annoying her, she tells me immediately, and I love that. It's very refreshing.
You're more sulky. So I found that hard, that he'd be getting quiet. I was like, what's wrong? And eventually you have to work it out. I say, right, that's it. You need to tell me what's the matter. We can't fix it. And he'd eventually give in. But we had rip roaring rows. And, you know, this was especially in our 20s. We would have.
Well, we grew up together as well. So we met in our early 20s, or at 20. Actually, you were 17 when we first met. Mm-hmm. So we grew up together through our 20s. And you change in your early 20s. And, you know, as you become, you work out who you are and where you want to go. And we did that together. Mm-hmm. And I think that's nice now, where I think we've reached a certain level of maturity that we can look back at, work out how we grew up together.
Well, Emma, talk to me about, you know, that part of growing up in your 20s, because you're from a very academic family and you were kind of always based in UCD growing up.
My dad was a lecturer in UCD in the Commerce Department, and my mom, she was did many masters and she was out in UCD. So for me, I suppose I'm like a university brat, really. I remember being brought out there as a child and, you know, seeing the students' union, remembering the smells of the arts building. This was something, UCD was a place that was, it was like golden mecca, I guess. Just, you know, my family have a great fondness and relationship with UCD. And so, you know, you're always going to UCD, you know. And I suppose for me, being, you know, I always wanted, I think my dream job was going to be a professor in the zoology department in UCD. That's what I wanted to do. I remember interviewing in Cambridge for PhD positions, interviewing for a position in the National Institute of Health that I got. And they said, well, where do you want to be in the next 5 to 10 years' time? And it was, you know, where I am right now. And, you know, I'm very happy to be there. So I'm lucky that it worked out.
That's wonderful. But your dad was, as you said, he was a lecturer in UCD. And he changed careers to... Well,
not necessarily changed careers. So he went to Harvard, did his PhD, and he got involved in his international marketing. He'll kill me now because I think that's what he did it in. But he then, instead of teaching about doing commerce, he did it himself. And so he now is the director of many companies. He's a founder of whiskey distilleries and so forth. And so he then, instead of doing just the academic side and teaching about how you do business, he spent a lot of time then just doing the business.
And were you ever tempted yourself to follow in your dad's footsteps and go into the whiskey business?
Well, what happened was, it was some, I was always told by my family, do what you love. I was always indulged. I said, listen, you've got to do what you absolutely love. And I remember when I was 15 going in, and when it was a full moon, none of us could sleep. And my parents talked to me about leptons and quarks and the cells. And I just thought, right, because, you know, you can be a butterfly biologist in the Amazon if you want to. I thought, right, I really love science. This is really what I want to do. But I was worried I could never make money or have a profession out of it. But then when I did, you know, BSc in zoology, and then did a master's in animal behaviour, and then did a PhD, I used to get all of these MBA applications in my name to all of these American universities.
So he wanted you to do
business. Oh yeah, I kept thinking. And then eventually said to my mom after, you know, when I had started, you know, 3 years into the postdoc, Deirdre, I think she's not going to go into business. So it's always something to think about. We have to explore all these options.
Indeed. And Peter, if you hadn't ended up in science, what do you think you would have done?
If I hadn't, I guess I was born thinking like a scientist. So I always wanted to be a scientist. Even as a kid, in my bedroom, I had a lab. It used to drive my mother mad. And my dad was an engineer, and I used to steal all the oil and the methylated spirits and the diesel and all these kind of things. And I put them in jars and put labels on them, and I had them in my bedroom. And this was when I was 10 or 11 or 12. It used to drive my mother mad because she used to think I'd poison myself in the room. So I was just always into science. And then when I got into my teenage years, I started thinking science or engineering because I wanted a career. I'd never thought I could make a career out of being, you know, an astrophysicist and going on to work in NASA. So I think there was never a doubt that I was going to be a scientist or an engineer. Now, you know, in contrast to Emma's family, neither of my parents had gone to university. But my dad was an engineer, a service engineer. And my mother and father were very supportive of us doing well in school. So if we did well in exams, you got a bike. Or if you did well in exams, you got a book. Or if you did. So there was always this kind of carrot to get us to do well at school. And their ambition for their kids was all to go on to college, all to go on to university. And they always said to us, do what you love as well. It's similar.
It seems common message.
Well, do what you love and work hard at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know,
hard.
They were the two things. And that's what I loved about Emma's family, that there's this thing about, you know, I don't care if you're stupid, work harder. And I love that kind of that kind of attitude. And that was similar in my family as well.
And Emma, tell me about this piece of music, Leaving on a Jet Plane. Why did you choose this piece?
So this is a song, I suppose, when I was growing up, my mom, so she, every time she would hear this song, she'd say, she's going to kill me. Sorry, ma'am. She would break down crying. We would be in an elevator. We would be in a supermarket. We would be anywhere at all. And even now, if she hears it, she'll cry, because I think that when, so she, her, she met my dad when they were, well, actually, they met before, so she was just in secondary school and then he was in college, but then she also went to UCD. So they had a relationship together in UCD and he was leaving to go off and do a master's and off into the States. And he went away quite a lot and she was here. So she associates the song with him going. Aww. And so she still breaks down crying even now, even after all these years they're married. So
lovely. Well, let's have a listen to John Denver.
So kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane. Don't know when I'll be back again. Oh, babe, I hate to go.
That's John Denver, Leaving on a Jet Plane, chosen by one of my guests this morning, Professor Emma Teeling, and her husband, Professor Peter Gallagher. I was wondering if either of you watched The Big Bang, because, you know, there's a biologist working with an engineer in that one. You know, it could be similar to yourselves.
I'm a great fan of The Big Bang Theory, and part of it is because I keep on looking at the textbooks in the background to see if they're actually the right textbooks, and to look at the equations on the board to make sure they're right, and they always are. In fact, there's a whole discussion board on the internet where you can work out if the equations are right in The Big Bang Theory. But, you know, as I always say to my friends, they're probably the coolest physicists that you could possibly meet. Physicists are not like that at all. Well, we're a mixed bag of kind of people, but they are the coolest physicists that you'll ever meet. I love the show. I think it's great.
Mm-hmm. But the thing that makes me feel a little nervous, because the caricatures are a little bit too real. I mean, this was what it was like doing a PhD in America. This is what it's like. Scientists are like that. And all of the actors aren't that far away from what we're really like, except, as Peter said, they are pretty much, much cooler than we are. So that's a little bit worrying.
I want to ask you now about moving back to Ireland, because it's the big decisions that you make as a couple, I think, that's really telling. And Peter, you had a really big job in NASA at the time. Can you tell me about that job and what it meant to you to have it?
Well, yeah, I mean, as a physicist, your dream is to work at NASA or CERN or the European Space Agency or something like that. And I landed this wonderful job working on a satellite at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center near Washington, D.C. It was a great place to work. The corridor below me, there was a guy called Bill Mather. He won the Nobel Prize for the COBE mission that looked at the Big Bang. You know, we used to have coffee with him or go for lunch with him. And he's just one of the guys on the corridor. So, you know, what an amazing place to work for somebody who's curious about the universe. It paid well as well. But I think we both had a dream about coming back to Ireland and doing great science in Ireland. And I don't know why we had that. But I wanted, if I was to spend my life doing good science, I'd like to do it in my own country for the benefit of that country. And I wanted to educate as well. I wanted to bring kids into science. So I was really interested in that. But also, I wanted to be beside my family. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to be near my family. And I wanted my kids to know their grandparents. And, you know, that was a real draw for us. And even today, I still work with NASA, you know, so I haven't lost that.
But the decision to come home was really down to Emma, because you were offered a really big job here in UCD.
Well, what actually happened, and it was quite serendipitous, to be honest, was that there was an advert for two jobs in UCD. One was for a one-year position to cover somebody going on sabbatical, I believe. And the other one was this permanent position in UCD in the zoology department, the one I really wanted, within the research area that I did. So if I didn't get this job, I could kiss my dreams of coming back to UCD to be in the zoology department goodbye, because usually these positions are for 30 years and they typically don't hire somebody who does the same thing. So we both applied at the same time. We had interviews within a week of each other. Peter found out he got the job. I was going in interviewing that day, and the next day I was told, right, we're going to tell you whether or not you've got the job. I said, okay, good, they're going to ring me. You know, made sure I gave them my mobile number twice, and there was no phone call the next morning. And we were just married. I was in Peter and Mom's house. I think she went to mass for the second time that day. And I thought, that's it. If they haven't given me the job, they're going to have to tell me to my face. And so I actually rang them up, and it was the HR department saying, well, you hadn't filled in a form. I was like, what form? You didn't fill in your health form. I was going, because I said, I didn't know I had to fill in the health form. And I said, well, do I have the job or not? And I said, well, actually, yes, you are the top candidate. So I was very excited. So I was lucky that I had the permanent position. Peter came back for a more temporary position. But he's very good at coping with that, better than I would be.
I was just going to ask there, because it's rare, I imagine, that within a couple, it's the woman then had the superior job and you were going to get paid more. How did you feel about that? Was there any professional jealousy there, Peter?
Well, I walked out of NASA on a Friday, and I remember walking out thinking, what the hell am I doing? I don't want to leave this place. And I had just been offered a promotion to do an even better job. So I just didn't want to leave. But Emma's dream was always to be a professor in UCD, and we always knew that. And part of my dream was also to be a professor in university as well. So anyway, we came back to Ireland, and I had a one-year...
Was that big for you to let go? I mean,
very
was that
hard.
A sacrifice?
Yeah, it really was. We thought and we talked about it long and hard. It wasn't an easy decision. And when I came back here, I took a huge pay cut, and also it was a one-year contract, you know, so it could have been the end of my career. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think I'm in a better place now in my career for having come to Ireland than I would have been if I'd stayed in NASA. If I'd stayed in NASA, I would have had a very interesting career. But being in Trinity, it's just the most wonderful place to work. I'm surrounded by young, enthusiastic, ambitious students who want to discover the way the world works, and I get to be there in that conversation. And I think a university is a beautiful place to be, to just be surrounded by these people. So my whiteboard in my office has equations all over, diagrams all over, because I'm sitting there arguing about science with these creative, smart undergraduate students or postgraduate students. Mm-hmm. And that's a great place to be. That's a real that's a wonderful environment for a scientist.
But Peter has the Midas touch, and I do think that you would have made the most out of whatever you were given. So I think I would have been a bit more freaked out and worried, and this is going to work, and much more stressed. It was better for the two of us that it was you that had more of the uncertainty than me. And I knew that you would always, I mean, you started up the astrophysics program in UCD. You did lots of other things while you were there at the time. Maybe you wouldn't dwell on these things as much as I would. So I think it worked out better for the two of us that the way it happened.
Well, you're both associate professors now. Is it difficult to juggle your careers and family?
Well, yeah. I would say absolutely. It's the hardest thing that I've ever been faced with, really. I remember I always thought that men and women were made equal. I never ever saw a gender difference, never saw coming up through my careers in science. And I was in a very male dominated part of biology, and it didn't ever daunt me. You see me and, you know, all the other males in the lab, and we just all hang out with the boys until I got pregnant. Then I realized actually I'm female. Being pregnant was hard. But the harder part was after giving birth, trying to manage the conflict between, you know, being a mother and also being a scientist, because I had a research lab that needed their mummy, mm-hmm. and I had a baby that needed their mom. And so I remember sitting on a chair just after Fionn, my eldest, was born, breastfeeding him, him lying in a breastfeeding pillow, the cat lying beside him. I was like, don't wake up the baby, and doing email. And that just, you have to try and find a balance, and it still is a constant juggle all the time. How do you manage it? How do you do it? For both of us, because Peter takes a huge role in parenting as well. Mm. So you're trying to find the right childminder, trying to see, well, how am I going to get in for this lecture? Trying to make sure that you're there for your important things in your kid's life, their Christmas play, things like that. How do you manage it all?
Can I ask a bit more about that, Emma? Because there are, you know, a very small number of women in high positions in a lot of jobs, and I think, I imagine, particularly in science as well. Is it because that balance is so hard?
It's a very good question, and I'm not sure, like, why does this happen? I think that it there's two things. I read Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In, and I think there's some very keen points, and I think any woman should read that. And it's not necessarily just about being in science. It's about men's and women's perception of each other's roles in society. And it's deep ingrained in all of us. For example, there was this very famous paper in Proceedings of Natural Sciences of America, whereby they had two CVs. They had exactly the same CV. They just changed the name. They sent these CVs to male and female scientists, exactly the same CVs. And they got them to say, well, who would you hire this person or would you not? And the men and the women systematically both decided not to hire the females, but to hire the males, just based on a name. That just goes to show you that there's this bias built into us. And that also, when you're thinking of who's the person who's going to step down when children are born, typically it's the females, but it doesn't have to be that way. But this is the way that society seems to dictate. Oh, yes, you've got to breastfeed. And so, you know, males don't have mammary glands. So it's going to be a bit more difficult if that's how you choose to feed your children. But this is something that after the kids are passed, if they're weaned of that stage, that both men and women can look after the kids. Dads make great parents too, but it's typically not done. So I think that is one thing that people think, oh, it's going to be too hard. I'm not going to be able to manage it all. The other thing is when people up on upper management are making decisions, do they pick women? Do they pick men? Again, a lot of times young male scientists too, they're mentored by other more, I suppose, established males. It's typically how it goes. And your mentoring helps move things along as well.
So what's the key for you to get that balance together?
Childcare. Having absolutely amazing childcare. I thank my mother-in-law hugely because she came and she's like Mary Poppins. She was a professional childminder. And when my eldest son didn't sleep for 4 years, and it was very, very difficult time trying to manage everything. But I was very lucky that I could walk out of the house knowing that he was looked after very well. Childcare, and also, if you can afford it, somebody to come and help clean the house. That... You know, you spend all your time either doing science or looking after kids. And so you really have to try and find that balance.
But, you know, sometimes work intrudes into your personal life or work intrudes into your family life. And you've got to keep it out because your mobile phone is too close and your emails are too close. And there's always something urgent to be done. And you want to try and keep that boundary between the kids and your work. And, you know, I love both of them. I my work keeps me awake at night, as do my kids. And I love both. I love both together. But, you know, I'm just thinking as Emma's talking there about when Fionn was born, in the hospital, I had a thesis, a PhD thesis with me in the hospital, and I had to read this PhD thesis because the following day after Fionn was born, I had to go and I was supervising the Viva. I was the internal examiner for the Viva.
So that's their kind of oral exam after
it's their
the PhD.
Oral exam, yeah, where they have to defend their work. But yeah, in there on the day, I had my PhD, the PhD with me.
So it's all consuming. So you've moved home to Clontarf. You've got your two beautiful boys. The careers are going well. Emma, what's your next aspiration? What's the next plan?
To actually find the secret of everlasting youth. So that is the plan. So we've been out now in the field in France catching all of these bats, doing what I think was nearly... I wrote this grant, was very happy with it. It's right, very ambitious. When you're actually trying to do this ambitious thing, you realise why nobody else has ever done it before, how difficult it can actually be. But we did it.
Are
we
you going out catching bats?
Yes, catching bats in these beautiful old churches in Brittany, bats that are tagged, that are labelled, taking a teeny tiny amount of blood from their tail membrane, freezing it in liquid nitrogen, making sure it stays cold, to look at what are these genes and proteins that are expressed, to try and understand why the old ones don't seem to be old in comparison with the young ones.
But when you find that out, you let me know and I will buy that whatever cream it is that you have.
It wasn't quite cream.
We brought the kids over to see Emma and her team working in the in these old churches, and it was 11 o'clock at night and the two boys were brought into this beautiful old church in Brittany. And there's all these bat biologists with their headlamps on, going up ladders, trying to get the bats to come out. And then they took the bats down and, you know, the boys were fascinated by opening up the wings and having a look at their teeth. And, you know, it's just wonderful.
Very,
to
very gothic,
see this.
Actually. I didn't really ever think of the connection. Bats and these ancient old churches, blood, all of the rest. But hopefully we'll find this cure. But much more important than cream. But it's more finding a way to deal with cancer or these horrible diseases of old age that cause us such pain.
Emma, you chose the song Welcome to the Jungle from Guns N' Roses. Can you tell me why?
This was, at 15, I believe that's how old it was, I absolutely loved Guns N' Roses. I thought they were the most amazing. It was one of the first LPs I'd ever bought, or albums, should I say, that I'd ever bought. And I used to listen to it all the time because I wasn't allowed to go out to any of these places. You know, they were trying to lock me away from the evil boys down the road. And I used to dance around to this all of the time. And this is just, as in dance around to the music from Guns N' Roses. But this is just a song that for some reason seemed to resonate with me and still does.
You come across as people who enjoy a good party because you're both like your rock. Would that be fair?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And Peter, is your way of letting off steam playing the guitar?
Yeah. Well, I wasted, well, maybe not wasted, but I spent a lot of my time playing guitar instead of studying for my Leaving Cert. So hence my Leaving Cert isn't as good as it should have been. But I was obsessed with trying to get this band, to get a gig, to get a record deal. And we never went anywhere. We were absolutely appalling. But I spent hours and hours and hours trying to reproduce the guitar solos from Guns N' Roses. And I still have the guitar in the house. I have three guitars in the house, actually. And Sunday mornings it gets cranked out and, you know, some AC/DC comes out across the airwaves at home.
And I always fancied long-haired hippies.
Well, we'll finish with Welcome to the Jungle from Guns N' Roses. Thank you to my guests this morning. Thank you to Gerfield Pott, who researched, Eileen Heron, who produced, and Noel Roberts on sound. I'll be with you again this time next week. Slán tamall.
Evin and Company on RTE Radio 1. Podcast the show at rte.ie/radio player.